Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The internet has made it easier than ever for us to listen to music. It's now possible to stream entire albums on services like Spotify for just $10 a month. You can stream almost any album you can think of on YouTube for free. iTunes offers an incredibly wide variety of music for 99 cents a song and albums under $10. But if music is so affordable and easy to access and even, in many cases, free, how are musicians surviving? With many challenges, there are also many benefits. There are no gatekeepers preventing distribution. It's a lot easier to reach fans all over the world. Even amateurs and hobbyists have an audience. But musicians need to be able to make money in order to take advantage of what the internet has to offer. And streaming services and illegal downloads are making that incredibly difficult. So how can we create a culture that allows artists to create music and make ends meet? How are musicians surviving in today's internet economy? And how does the future of the music industry reflect how other artists will make a living online? Today we are joined by Count, also known as Michael Eldridge. He's a San Francisco-based musician, producer, engineer, and mixer, whose list of clients includes Radiohead, Frank Sinatra, and the Rolling Stones. He's currently working on a documentary called Unsound. It examines how musicians and creators survive in the age of free. And Count joins me here in studio. Hi, Count. Thanks for coming in.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Kristen Thompson. She's a consultant with the nonprofit Future of Music Coalition. She's co-director of their Artist Revenue Streams Research Project, a study examining how musicians' revenue streams are changing and why. And she joins us from Philadelphia. Hi, Kristen. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rose.
Great to have you. So, Count, I understand with your documentary Unsound, there's a lot of pressure because a lot of musicians want you to get the story right. What is the story today? I mean, about 10 years ago, there was the huge controversy with Napster and Metallica making a huge stand saying that they didn't want you to download their music online. But what about today? What's the big story?
Well, I think that's you hit the nail on the head that for most people, for the average music fan, the story sort of went away, right? Because for them, for your music fan, things have never been better right now, right? You can access any music you want to on any device at any time, and you don't even really have to pay for it if you don't want to. So it's important for music fans to know what the story is. And for most of them, they were either too young to remember that in the first place from a decade ago, or they don't know what has happened since then. And for the past decade, the narrative that has sort of persisted, you know, in the public's eye is that there were these big, bad, greedy record labels, and Napster took that whole system down, and hooray, and everything's fine, right? Because if you're a fan, things have never been better.
Right.
So you're not really digging deeper into what the real story is, which is, you know, how are your favorite artists able to survive if everything is free? That's a huge story because it goes way beyond the music business. It impacts everybody who creates anything. If you're a filmmaker, a journalist, a photographer, you know, the internet doesn't distinguish the difference between music and a photograph. It's just data. So it can be downloaded and it can be quote unquote shared.
So you make a good point because as a huge music fan, I mean, you as you said, you can download almost any album you can think of. And then, like I said, from San Rafael that has amazing venues to San Francisco to Santa Cruz, there are so many shows a night, averaging $10 to $20, unless, of course, you go to the Fillmore, but that rarely reaches $50 or $60, right? And then if you go to these festivals, three-day festivals for maybe $200, and bands play from about 11 until 3 in the morning,
yeah.
I mean, it is an amazing time to be a music fan.
And the important thing to point out here is that I think most one of the – there are a whole series of myths that – really kind of started around the era of that Napster, around 2000, the Napster trial, where, I mean, there's a whole slew of them, but I focus on the most, you know, widely perpetuated myths in my film. And one of them is the myth that, well, okay, artists don't make money from their recorded music anymore, but they weren't making money anyway. Some big greedy label was taking all that money. So artists don't really care. They make their money from touring. Well, as it turns out, that's, you know, not exactly true. The venues that you just mentioned, like the Fillmore, those are the artists that have made it. Those are to use that overused expression, that those are the 1%. But the rest of the artists out there that have struggled to make it to where they actually have a real fan base. I'm not talking about Facebook fans. I'm talking about real fans that would have bought your record. You know, if you're able to fill up a 500 capacity venue, you're basically breaking even. So most artists actually lose money touring. They don't make money touring.
Kristen, do you agree with Count? Do you think that music fans don't really know how difficult it is to make ends meet because it's such a great time to be a music fan?
I think there probably are some, music fans that don't understand the complex nature of the music ecosystem, which does involve a lot of different stakeholders and sort of parts of the mechanisms of the music industry that most music fans just don't know about. You know, publishers, booking agents, venue promoters, the managers, all the folks that make it work are also partly, benefactors of the artists going out and doing things, whether it's creating studio recordings or going out on tour. So I do think that the internet and the conversations that musicians are having, including the kind that are in Count's documentary and the kind of work that FMC does, Future Music Coalition does help us to illuminate some of the complex nature of the music ecosystem and how it's changing over time.
So Count, what did you hear from musicians and what are they facing right now?
Well, I think the important thing for them is that people understand what their life is really like, because, for the past decade, I think people are still stuck on this idea of musicians being this stereotype of the MTV Cribs, rolling in cash, getting huge advances from record labels, and that's just not the reality. In fact, the reason why I focused on independent artists in my film is that they kind of represent the middle class, right, and so to speak. And there are artists that you've heard their name, you've probably bought an album, you've probably seen them live, that, for them, paying rent at the end of the month is still, a tricky situation. So especially now that they're not generating income off of their recorded music. And it's important for music fans to understand that because, performing music is your most expensive money that you make, right? It requires you, first of all, being away from your family and everyone, your life, for weeks at a time. But it also costs a ton of money to tour. So that money that you make is your most expensive money. And recorded music, on the other hand, that was the thing that really sparked that's what kickstarts your whole career, your whole ecosystem is based off of that. So if you don't have that income, and if you're not one of the artists, the 1% who actually make money touring, then you're talking about losing money off of your recorded music and losing money off of your tours. Well, how's that going to work out? That's not sustainable. And it gets to the point where you realize, where fans should realize, and hopefully will realize, that unless you're supporting your favorite artists, they're not going to be able to continue to make more music. Now, of course, this is not to scare everyone into thinking that all music is going to go away. That's not the case. There will always be artists, up and coming artists willing to step up and make music, and they'll always be willing to do that for free. The problem is, and what's heartbreaking, is that your favorite band may not be able to make that second record because life reality just gets in the way. They have to take a day job and they stop creating.
What is the best way to support bands?
It's still, and I have several people on film saying this, but really, still, by far, the best way to support an artist is just to simply buy their album. It sounds so ridiculous and old school, and it sounds so simple, I feel embarrassed even saying it, because this is a heavy issue. The film covers and goes into territory that gets highly intellectual, but at the end of it, well, you just have to support the band by buying their record.
From where?
Directly from them is always the best.
Okay. So, for example, if you go to a concert and they're selling their CDs in the back,
right.
That's the best place to buy it.
Right.
And if you can't do that, I'm thinking an independent record store, if you're lucky enough to still have one.
And these days, I mean, most artists have a way to buy their record from their website.
Right.
Sometimes they forward you onto iTunes, which is great. iTunes takes their percentage. But the artist or copyright holder, if that artist happens to be signed to a record label, they're still making a majority of that money, right? It's roughly a 70-30 split, right? Bandcamp is another new system where they take even less. And that's as sort of direct as you can get for purchasing music. And you also have, you know, they have the ability on Bandcamp where you can put I guess what you call variable payment. You pay what you want. You can essentially donate extra money if you know that it's an independent band and they're probably not doing that well, but you really love their music. You don't have to pay the 99 cents for the song, but you could pay $5 or $10 for a song.
So if you're going to do it online, you should go through iTunes?
Yeah, iTunes is a great one. Bandcamp is the other one. And direct from the artist if they offer that.
Kristen, what would you say about that? Is that the best way to support musicians? Buy their album?
Yeah, I'd agree. And I'm glad that Count brought up the point about variable pricing that's available on Bandcamp if bands choose to set it up that way, which... I heard the fellow from Bandcamp mention it at some, you know, recent conference that he's surprised sometimes at how many people overpay for sound recordings when they buy them through Bandcamp if the variable pricing is an option. And that is something that prior to, you know, the development of some of these platforms was pretty much impossible to offer to fans, you know, of the ability to overpay for things or to bundle a, you know, say a new digital download with a T-shirt sale. You might be able to do that at a venue where you're selling merch on a table and you say, hey, buy the shirt and the record and I'll, you know, you can get them both for $20. But in the sort of retail environment, that wasn't really possible until recently. And now bundling is an option, which is pretty cool. It's just one more way to leverage the value of a sound recording, you know, sort of create an economy around it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's important too for people to be aware that although that platform exists, right now, it's such a minority of music fans are actually using it in that way. But the only thing really getting in the way of that becoming the norm is that music fans don't really know the story. They don't know what's happening right now. To them, they still think, well, some greedy big record label was taking all that artist's money, so I don't really want to support that. I'm going to download the music, or I'm just going to take it from my friend's hard drive, or I'll just stream it on YouTube. All of those, Spotify, those are all ways to not support artists. And, you know, and tell people, it's just like any issue, any global issue, any social issue, any environmental issue. If you don't know what the facts are, that's sort of the reality of the situation, you can't really make an informed decision, right? And that's unfortunately where we're at in the music business. People don't know what's really happening.
And then, Kristen, when you're talking about independent bands, is it safe to assume that they're with an independent label? And how does the profit really work and the sort of cash distribution work when you're talking about independent labels versus the large ones?
It varies a lot from label to label. I ran an independent label in the 90s, and we split everything 50-50 after expenses were covered with the band. So that was a fairly common business model of some of the independent labels around. I assume that there are other labels who have different kind of profit splits, or that they mimic the sort of percentage relationships that some of the bigger labels use, so that you get, you know, say, 10 to 15% of retail sales or something. It's really hard to know because, you know, labels all have their own business models. But there is this other class of musicians we should also mention. We have mentioned a little bit, but it's the folks who are unaffiliated with any label. They, in fact, are their own label. Those are musicians and bands who are using the platforms like CD Baby and TuneCore to have these platforms help artists get their music into the bigger digital retail services like iTunes and Amazon and Spotify and Rhapsody. And so in the case of CD Baby, you pay a one-time fee, and then CD Baby sends you back 91% of the profits you may get from sales or streams from any of the platforms. with the case of TuneCore, there's an annual payment to keep your product available, and they send back 100% of the royalties that you generate. So there's different models out there, and musicians are, you know, trying to pick through which ones are best suited to their particular, you know, position.
That's an important point that you bring up, is that, you know, I think, again, for most music fans, they think of artists as being signed to some record label. And the vast majority of artists are actually not signed to any label at all. And that's one of the great positives of the internet revolution, is that, you know, now the barrier to entry is now lower. There's no gatekeepers. You can exercise your great creativity that this new technology is brought to you. And so we have more people creating, more people making albums. And in fact, you know, although a lot of people have watched this trailer that I made and thought, well, God, you know, you bring up all these negative things, but what about all these positive things that have happened? And trust me, they're in the film. But if you were to take, you know, a sort of a pros and cons list, if you're a creator, if you're a musician, you know, your list might include like 100 positives, 100 pros in the new internet revolution, right? You creating music has never been easier. It's more affordable. You can reach more fans. You have no gatekeepers. You can promote easier. And then on the cons side, there are very few things, but those very few things are so important that they almost overwhelm all of the positives. So if you take the one major pro or major con on that list, which is the whole making a living part, you know, if you can't make a living doing what you do, then you take a day job, then you aren't able to create more music. Mm. And that's a very important thing that people need to understand.
Kristen, do you agree with that based on the research that you've conducted?
We found when we asked musicians about their feelings about technology, and when in the artist revenue streams work, we had three different ways we collected data. We did interviews, we did financial case studies, and we did a big online survey that was answered by 5,300 musicians and composers. And we asked about, you know, how have you, what's your feelings about technology, which ones have been a positive and which ones have negatively impacted you or been a substitute for, you know, other revenue streams. And we did get a huge range of answers, especially in the interviews. Some people were, you know, thrilled that they could work in a location and deliver, say, soundtrack edits to Los Angeles and they don't live there. They could, be their own boss, not give up their copyrights, not sign a deal, all those things. But the negative, one of them that nobody really said that they were, there were a lot of people concerned about how their revenue streams were shifting. And some people were very concerned because it was so clear to them that technology was having an impact on the core revenue streams for them. For example, folks who compose for film and TV have one person that we interviewed talked a lot about how the price point that he's able to charge or expect to make an offer on to, say, do a soundtrack for a film has dropped because of something Count said, which is it's so much easier and faster and cheaper to make recordings. And so the market is flooded with opportunities for people to actually do that work. So it's harder for the sort of even established composers to charge the same price. So yeah, it's just that the technology has shifted the revenue streams and especially the size of some of them.
That is Kristen Thompson. She's a consultant with the nonprofit Future of Music Coalition. She's co-director of the Artist Revenue Streams Project. It's a study examining how musicians' revenue streams are changing and why. And Count, also known as Michael Eldridge, is a San Francisco-based musician, producer, and mixer. His clients include Radiohead, Frank Sinatra, and the Rolling Stones. He's currently working on the documentary Unsound, which examines how musicians and creators survive in the age of free. And we'd love to hear from you. If you're a musician, how do you make ends meet? How are you using digital tools to turn a profit? Do you perform live, sell merchandise? What would you say to those of us who are huge music fans? How can we best support you? And what changes have you seen over the past few years? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And if you're a music fan, How do you make sure that you're supporting the artists that you love? And how do you listen to music? And please be honest, if you don't buy an album and if you just stream it, give us a call and tell us why. Maybe it's something that you just don't spend that much time thinking about. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So, Kristen, with this project, because you spoke to so many musicians and got responses from so many, what are some of the other highlights? What changes concern them the most, and then where do they see positive changes?
One surprising thing we heard in the interviews and then was reflected in the data as well from the survey was that there's an instance of how, you know, there are a number of revenue streams have changed over time, and in fact, there's more ways for musicians to earn money from their compositions, their songs, or their sound recordings, or their brands themselves, their persona, or their performances, and those have expanded over the past 15 years. And one of the interesting ones that stuck out was the impact of digital performance royalties. A number of interviewees said that they noticed that as an increased revenue stream, sort of one that had popped up for them. And what it is that when sound recordings are streamed on digital platforms, and that includes Pandora, SiriusXM, any webcast station, there's a royalty generated that goes to Sound Exchange, which is a collective that distributes the money. And 45% goes to the featured artist, 50% goes to the record label, and 5% goes to session musicians and background singers and all that. And it's basically a new right. You know, it came into law because of a congressional act in 1995, but it didn't really get set up till 2002. And over time, they've not only collected but distributed more and more money. So, you know, awareness of Sound Exchange has grown over the past 10 years, and that might just be what we saw in the data and in the interviews, but that one really stuck out as something that is a new revenue stream that people had noticed.
And then we talked about this briefly earlier, but I wanted to spend more time on concerts just because we have so many venues in Northern California. Mm-hmm. New ones are popping up constantly. But you go to a venue, like, say, the Independent in San Francisco, $20. I don't know how many people, maybe 200? What do bands make when they play in these kinds of venues?
It's interesting you brought that up. Actually, one of the people that I interviewed in this film was from the band Galactic, and they're well known here because they have a really good tour base, and they tour a lot, and they pack venues. And they're a band that never sold many records to begin with. They were sort of known as this live act. Well, one of the guys in the band, when he first started, he recounted this time seeing a show at Tipitina's in New Orleans, and he's like, wow, there's thousand people here roughly, and he's kind of doing the math in his head. He's like, I paid $20 for this ticket, that's $20,000. That's pretty good. This is when he was, you know, really first starting to get into this, hoping that he could make a living at it. And, you know, he felt really confident telling his dad, you know, I'm going to be a musician. No, trust me, we're playing bigger venues and this is going to work out. Now later, having toured for, you know, 15 to 20 years, he realizes that the expenses are so high. And the math that he had done quickly in his head was the same math that most music fans do when they're at a show. Mm-hmm. And they think that band is playing on a stage and there's a full crowd. They're making money.
Yeah. And hold that thought. We'll continue that after the break. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
Everyone deserves music, sweet music. Everyone deserves music. Sweet music. 7 in the morning, step on the floor, walking through the kitchen and you open the door. Ain't much left in the bottle of juice because the seeds that you're planting never reproduce. Computer's still running but your mind is cracked because the plans that you made never came to pass. Now you're recognizing the times is hard when you're trying to take a bite at your ATM card. Everyone deserves music. Deserves music, sweet music. Mm-hmm.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about cell phone radiation. How concerned should we be about it? We will speak with scientists about how cell phones might be affecting our health. We'll talk about some recent studies and find out what cities are doing. In San Francisco, retailers have to warn us about emissions from the phones and possible links to increased risk of cancer. So that's tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about how independent musicians make a living. It's a great time to be a fan of music, especially in Northern California. So many venues, so many great bands. But how do those bands make music when you can download just about any album you can name on YouTube? And if you want to pay for it, Spotify is only $10 a month. iTunes, it's 99 cents a song. So we're talking about how musicians are making a living, and we'd love to hear from you. We have one line open, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Kristen Thompson, consultant with the nonprofit Future of Music Coalition. They're out with a lengthy project looking at how musicians' revenue streams are changing and why. We're also joined by Count, also known as Michael Eldridge. He's a San Francisco-based musician and producer who works with Radiohead, Frank Sinatra, and the Rolling Stones. He's currently working on a documentary called Unsound, which looks at how musicians and creators survive in the age of free. So we'll get to calls in a minute, but before the break, you were just talking about how difficult it is to play in venues, even when you sell them out.
Yeah.
How expensive it is.
You really have to be playing venues that are, you know, in roughly the 1,000 capacity range, at least 500 and above, to where you're actually generating income. But keep in mind, even though you are technically making money, you are spending so much money to make that money. That and the fact that you're gone, you know, 200 and something days out of the year, does that sound like a sustainable living? Well, the answer is no. And most importantly is that there are a lot of people who are able to now create music, and they can increase their fan base. They can become popular online. They can grow. Those amount of artists can grow almost infinitely, right? However, the amount of venues in this country is definitely not growing. The amount of days in the year is definitely not growing either, right? So there's a finite amount of bands that can make a living touring because, as I said, the only a few venues really in this country which are venues where the bands actually are going to make a living.
Like, for example, I just saw Pearl Jam on Tuesday night at the Oakland Arena. $90 for a ticket.
Yeah.
I think 20 went to Ticketmaster.
Sure.
But that's for a big band.
Right.
They're obviously making money.
And that's what most people think of when they think of bands on tour. They think of the big venues and the bigger artists, and they think there's not a problem there. Well, we're talking about a handful of artists really in the grand scheme of things. And what we really should be thinking of is the way we think of the normal economy, right? Our regular economy, we say immediately, oh, this is not working because it's working for the top 1% and everybody else is struggling. But for some reason, the past decade in the music business, we say, oh, well, it's working fine without looking at the middle class, which is sort of eroding.
Hmm. Well, we've got full lines. Let's hear from Richard in New York. Hi, Richard. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah. Hi. I have a record label. I'm coming at it from a different end. And the problem is not just with the artists. Everybody is getting squeezed. We're a fairly new label. We're about 4 years old, and we're on Spotify. And we had one CD, a poetry CD, and it got in one period it got 7,000 hits, and we received a check for I think $45.
Wow.
That we had to split that with the artist. You know?
Yeah.
I was embarrassed to write the check, but I don't see any way out of this if they don't do something about Spotify, Pandora, and their
so Richard
all over the world.
I don't use Spotify, but I have a lot of friends who love it, and I understand that for $10 a month, that's it, you can access almost every album you can imagine, and you can play it over and over again, right? There are no restrictions.
Well, most people don't use the subscription. They use the free version. So that right off the bat is one of the big problems. But there's a whole secondary problem, which is even if you use the paid service, how much of that money is actually going to the artist? And that really brings up a fundamental issue, which is, you know, after over a decade of piracy, it devalued recorded music to such a degree that it enabled services like Spotify and YouTube to offer minuscule payments per stream to artists, which these never would have been, these terms never would have been accepted 15 years ago when people bought music. But after a decade of piracy, they can come in and say, well, either you get $0 from piracy or you accept this fraction of a penny per stream. What will it be?
So, Richard, how would you like to see a service like Spotify actually run so it benefits the artist and you as a music label owner?
Well, there's a real problem because the public has gotten used to free music. And there are actually in Europe and Asia, we're distributed worldwide. And we have income from streams in Europe and Asia, and they pay 2-3 cents a stream. There's also a college deal that we have that through universities, and they pay 2 or 3 cents a stream. But I don't even know if that's enough to sustain a label or sustain artists. This is a problem the electronics have taken over the business. The CDs that used to sell 50,000 copies are now selling 6,000 copies. And frankly, our company is looking at smartphone apps and licensing and every single revenue stream we can develop to stay in business, because the CD sales just don't get there. We did a children's CD with Catherine Zeta-Jones and Michael Douglas. We didn't get any real sales on that, and things you would think that something like that would really move. But if we had it on Spotify, which we didn't, I'm sure we would have gotten thousands and thousands of hits and no money. I'm at a loss, as a matter of fact. You know, when your guest said, "Go to iTunes," I agree with you. I would love to see 99 cents for a download, if they can get it for free on Spotify, why bother?
Well, thank you for calling. Kristen, what would you say to Richard and others in his situation?
It is definitely a changing, evolving time. And it's interesting because today Spotify launched a website called Spotify for Artists. And they publicized for the first time the formula that they use to actually calculate the rate by which they pay artists. But they wanted to make sure that in this website they talk about that they don't pay artists directly, they pay rights holders. And usually rights holders means a record label. But just as a reference to who we talked about earlier, there's plenty of musicians out there who are also their own record label. So they receive the payments through a digital aggregator like CD Baby or TuneCore. Needless to say, there are other parts of this equation that are likely to change over time. What Count said is true. The streaming services need to boost the number of paid subscribers because the rate and the sort of general revenue for the companies will go up if there's more paid subscribers. I know a lot of them, and I don't work for any of these companies, but I'm sure they're interested in expanding the number of countries they're available in and stuff. But I think also it's important that the artists who are sort of at the end of the food chain continue to discuss and talk about the payments, because it encourages transparency and accountability amongst these new services to recognize that, the artists at the very end of the food chain need to, the services that are going to survive in the long run are going to be the ones that satisfy both the music fan and the creators. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you again for calling in. Let's go next to Robert in Richmond. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you, Rose. And I hope you can hear me. I had to get on the move. I want to thank you, first of all, for doing the show. I'm a longtime music fan and a longtime music player and amateur and a lawyer in my day job. But I, in the Bay Area, like many people, know dozens of really fine musicians who like Count and the other woman said, are basically not able to make a functional living, who are as talented and put as many, if not more, years into their profession as I've done. And the distance between our incomes is, I won't say obscene since I'm the one making it, but it's really just, my concern is two things. I've watched venues where they could at least make some money, local venues, die, because they're not able to collect as much revenue as they want, either, I guess, because of the gray wave or people just aren't going out. I'm talking about local bars, restaurants that used to use live music. The second thing is, I don't go along with the idea that somehow the generation that is now basically stealing, shoplifting music doesn't understand what it's doing. I personally think that if we're going to go after the large oil companies and other corporations for their mishandling of their power, which I'm all for, I think we need to go against Spotify and any number of these online internet sites. And I think that there are plenty of resources to do that. And I think that they'd probably be effective. I think in about 4 or 5 years, you would see a system evolve where people pay for music.
You brought up a great point. So one of the interviews I did was with Brett Gurewitz, who's the guitarist for Bad Religion. He also founded an independent label called Epitaph, which has and Anti Records, which has an amazing artist roster, including Tom Waits. He's a very smart guy, and he brought up something that I'd said several times. He almost verbatim said the same thing, which is, you know, for about a decade, this narrative existed where I think young music fans felt like they were sticking it to the man when they downloaded music, right? They really wanted to believe this narrative that there was some big greedy record labels screwing artists, and therefore that they felt justified in downloading music. But it's important to point out that, A, that wasn't true, right? There's probably a handful of examples where artists were screwed by record labels, but it's important to point out that record labels can't be all lumped into one thing, right? There are hundreds of independent record labels that are supporting artists nonstop, and they're absolutely essential to the artists', you know, careers, as well as the major ones. Let's not forget that the major labels, as much as you might, you know, disapprove with how they handled the situation, they're the ones, they brought you the Ramones and the Clash, and, you know, you can call them the man, but what's really important that Brett Gurewitz pointed out was that, so every day these young kids are filling up their cars with gas from BP. They're eating genetically modified food from Monsanto, and they've chosen to rail against me. I'm not the man. I'm an independent record label, and I'm in a punk rock band. I'm not the man. You're railing against the wrong person.
And Bad Religion just came out with a new CD.
Right.
Well, Kristen, so what about that? I mean, have you spoken with music fans, and how do you change their way of thinking? Because what you're all talking about here is that in order to really support the band, you have to pay for the music, which is, what, $12 an album, right?
On average. Has to come from somewhere, right? Everything can't be free, right? That should be a huge red flag to anybody, because just like in any other part of our lives, if something's free, you kind of have to scratch your head and go, what's the catch here?
But that would change thinking, because I think what you had is Napster, Metallica, and then Pearl Jam took on Ticketmaster, and people got really angry about just the sort of, like you said, the man who's making all the money, and this is a way to kind of revolt. So how do you change that way of thinking, and do you think it's possible? Kristen?
Oh, yes, well, to your question, we haven't spoken to a lot of fans, except in one instance we did a survey amongst college-age students at a big university, a big state university, about how they consume music and how it's changed over time. And the surprising result was they were mostly listening on YouTube as opposed to downloading music.
Yeah.
And that was like 4 years ago. You know, I think music fans had just shifted from the accumulation of music to just the streaming of it. So there was that. And now I'm lost in my point here about how to educate, I guess, the music fan.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think that it's an ongoing process, and musicians who are understand that it's a complicated ecosystem, and that it's important that music fans are aware of how it works, and that they encourage them to use, like, for example, using your website to point your music fans to licensed legal services, the kind that you like, or the places where you might be offering a special cool thing, like on Bandcamp, or using your own website to offer awesome deals to shows or something like that, encourages music fans to do the right thing for the bands that they're supporting. So I would think that musicians can do a number of things to sort of encourage good behavior.
And that's the reason why I making the film in the first place. Just people need to understand the reality of the situation, that they watch their favorite artists just basically living and find out what their lives are like and how they feel about the situation. I think things could change.
And that is Count, also known as Michael Eldridge, who is making the documentary Unsound, looking at how musicians and creators survive in the age of free. And Kristen Thompson is a consultant with the nonprofit Future of Music Coalition. And let's hear next from Randall Klein, calling from the SF Jazz Center. Hi, Randall. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Good to talk to you. Interesting conversation. And I run a live music venue here in San Francisco. We just built a beautiful new building. And I've been producing, you know, music in the Bay Area for over 30 years. And, you know, things certainly have changed, and I've, you know, sat in a position to see a change around me. But there are lots of alternatives. The world is changing. In fact, you know, our fundamental bet is on live music and what we're doing here and what, you know, our next stage in this particular building, which is, you know, beautiful state-of-the-art building, is to try to figure out ways to extend our reach beyond, you know, the live music that people experience here. But there are a number of artists who, you know, I think are great examples of taking advantage of your guests have been talking about, which is how to monetize, how to make a living from music. It's changed. The old paradigm definitely is, while still there, doesn't work quite the way it used to. And there is lots of opportunity. I mean, you know, we just mentioned YouTube, you know, as a source, or at least 4 years ago, as a source for people to listen to music. But, you know, YouTube is an opportunity and become an opportunity for a number of creative artists actually to make a living, while not necessarily from what YouTube pays them, but from profile. There's a wonderful example of a couple of artists here in the Bay Area who I think are sort of the poster children of how to make a living via YouTube and alternate, you know, forms of digital media. It's a group called Pomplamoose, Jack Conti and Natalie Don, and they have, you know, built a huge YouTube channels around their music, and they sell music via the iTunes store off of that. And they actually are making a better living than most touring bands. They've also taken advantage of another medium. In fact, they've got a concert coming up this week on Stage It. I don't know if you've talked, I didn't hear the beginning of the show whether anyone mentioned this as another venue, but this is a digital venue where the analogy is playing for tips, basically. And I know that they, you know, I've heard from them that they actually make more money doing a half-an-hour broadcast, which is basically just opening up their laptop in their house and playing a concert, not quite as casual as that, but pretty close, and making more money than doing a sold-out East Coast concert tour. And those are things that weren't available, you know, 10 years ago to people, and it's a platform. So there's just new ways to do it, and I think, you know, it is a time of transition, and the whole, you know, ecosystem is evolving rapidly, but it isn't one nor the other, and there's no one way to do it, as with all of our consumption of media here. It's a very flat playing field with lots of choices, and you've got to find your way through it, but there are ways through.
Randall, let me ask you, we just got an email from Carl, who wanted to know what it's like for sort of out of the mainstream musicians, people who are not, you know, into rock or like jam bands. What is it like for jazz musicians in this climate?
It's the same paradigm as what's been talked about. I mean, people have to figure out a way to make a living. You know, artists are like the rest of us. You know, everyone has to, you know, put food on the table, pay rent, you know, put kids through school, do all the things that, you know, people do in their lives, and they choose music or some kind of art to make a living. So for jazz musicians, it's, you know, similar to a lot of rock musicians, to a lot of similar to classical musicians. You find other ways to make a living, hopefully close to the thing you love most. So in jazz, you know, a lot of the paradigm around, depending on the level of artist, but people make living, you know, help make a living teaching. That's a very popular thing for classical musicians. You may land the good gig, at a symphony, or you land a good gig, a band that works a lot, or your own band works a lot, and you supplement your income from teaching, or you supplement your income from touring, or you supplement your income from selling CDs or downloads. And jazz musicians, like most rock musicians, same thing, particularly at the emerging level state. You're clawing for audiences. You're trying to get in front of people. The audiences are interesting enough where once you're in front of a live audience, that's your best platform these days to sell CDs.
Well,
can I bring this up?
Sure.
What Randall described is something that we definitely noticed in our artist revenue streams work. We did financial case studies of a jazz band leader composer, and separately one of a jazz sideman. And we also did a contemporary chamber ensemble, and their revenue pies looked very different. But what Randall described is really a reflection of what those particular jazz musicians and contemporary classical folks were talking about, which was there's a range of things, and it involves a little bit of teaching, a little bit of side work, session work, some grants, a very tiny slice of merchandise, but also they're usually their biggest vendor of recorded music sales. So yeah, it's all piecing it together.
Well, I'd like to bring something up obvious here that's actually quite important, which is, so yes, I agree that is the reality, that people are looking to other, sources for revenue, and there are more of those available. They're tiny and minuscule, and they don't pay your rent, but yes, there are more of them. But is that what we want? I mean, if you asked anyone in any other industry, hey, here's your profession, whatever it is that you do. Sorry, it's just a sign of the times. Technology's, changed, and so your career is now going to mean that you're going to make, one-tenth of what you used to make, and you're just going to have to go out and do other things. Well, that's not the I understand that that's the reality, but is that what we want as a society? Shouldn't we be striving to make things better? I personally don't want musicians making T-shirts in order to make a living or having to teach lessons. We can't all teach lessons. There are millions of musicians out there, and thousands of them deserve to be able to make a living. They can't all teach. They can't all tour. Their recorded music has value. It's worth something. And that's what I feel like we should be focusing on.
Well, and then you have people like Peter, who just wrote in and said, I've been making music for 20 years. The situation has not changed with the internet. There have always been a minute number of artists who can actually make a living. The music economy as a job maker isn't existed. It's never existed. To pretend that file sharing is taking away people's livelihoods is ludicrous. He's basically saying art is not a business.
No, so that he brings up a common myth that gets perpetuated, which is, well, things have always been bad, so it's okay that they're bad now. Well, look, if things are bad, shouldn't we make them better? Shouldn't we fix that? If in any other industry, if you're popular and you have a product that people want, you deserve to make a living off of that.
Unless
right?
you're a journalist or right. a writer.
So, but when you're in the content creating world, this is a problem now, and it's more of a problem than it used to be. So we shouldn't be saying that, okay, the new system sucks. Well, the old one sucked too. Hmm. Well, that's not a viable argument.
What do you think, Kristen?
I think the musician's perspective on whether it's better or worse, it really just depends on what their own position is. And I'm mostly just referring to the data that we collected and the interviews we did. So everyone's perspective is pretty much based on the genre, their role, their career trajectory, their experience, their motivation and goals. So it's sort of hard to have a specific answer to that because some people are like, I love the new freedom I have. I love being an entrepreneur. I love being strategic about my work. And others are like, I'm really, really worried about how I'm going to make money in the future. So I think it just varies so much from artist to artist.
Well,
let's
just hear from one more artist before we end. Let's hear from James Nash, the guitarist with the band The Waybacks. Hi, James. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much. Yeah, I've experienced so many of the things that Count is describing. My band, The Waybacks, was full-time for a while, and we were spending more time on the road than we were at home. But even during those times, I was doing things on the side, session work, teaching lessons. I made an instructional video. I write for a magazine. And I think that, the more musicians that you talk to, the more that you hear that same story, that everybody is doing things on the side in order to make ends meet. And now that my full-time band is on hiatus, I'm spending most of my time doing things like producing and playing as a sideman on commercial sessions and teaching more lessons. And the irony of it is I make way more money doing that than I ever have as an artist, in quotes. The kind of the holy grail, I think, of why we all get into music is to write and record and perform our own music. And so, unfortunately, those are the things that I have found that, that pay the least money. And there are, the rare exceptions of artists who I think make a ton of money doing that, but most don't. And So I think there's some middle ground between the idea that your favorite band is just going to get a day job and quit and no longer make music. But I think the reality is that the amount of time that they may be putting into what they do and what you love listening to starts to shrink, so that your favorite band says, well, you know, we don't have to get day jobs, but we're going to have to do a bunch of other things with our musical talents to try to make ends meet. So the amount of time we're actually going to spend creating music is much smaller. Mm.
Well, thank you so much for calling, James. And we have about 30 seconds left.
Yeah, so I have an important point there, and that is that, you know, it's great if you have those opportunities. Most people can't get those. You can't just be a band, even a popular band, and get gigs doing music for film or commercial or video games. Those are very difficult, coveted positions, and they don't come close to being an opportunity for all the bands that should be making a living that now aren't.
That is Count, also known as Michael Eldridge. He is working on a documentary called Unsound, taking a look at how musicians and creators survive in the age of free. Kristen Thompson is a consultant for the nonprofit Future of Music Coalition. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you. And thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. How concerned should we be about cell phone radiation? On the next Your Call, we'll talk to scientists about how cell phones might be affecting our health. A recent study looks at the incidence of breast cancer in women who keep cell phones in their bras. In San Francisco, cell phone retailers are required to warn customers that emissions from phones might be linked to the increased risk of cancer. So what do you want to know about how to use your cell phone safely? It's Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.